Baseball Tonight is presented by LinkedIn Jobs.
Way out of here.
Oh, this is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, April 15th, 2021. Jackie Robinson Day in Baseball, the 74th anniversary of the day that Jackie Robinson became the first African-American player to appear in a major league game for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Producing today's show from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. And Taylor, Jackie Robinson Day, and man, we talked a little bit about it yesterday. This really fun interview with Brian Helgeland, who was the writer and director of the movie 42.
Yeah, he really gave us the full rundown on everything from the day that he gets involved with the project unwittingly, casting Chadwick Boseman, which is just a great story. And then really the cherry on top is Rachel Robinson's reaction to the movie. I think everyone's really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, that was really moving. And then having that conversation with him, and you'll hear his emotion as he describes what Rachel said to him right after she saw the movie for the first time. All right, some news and notes. Twin shortstop Andrelton Simmons tests positive for coronavirus. This after he declined a vaccine. Simmons told reporters he doesn't plan to take the vaccine, which was made available in a single shot dosage to the team at Target Field last Thursday. Derek Falvey, the head of baseball operations for the Twins, told reporters that Simmons had mild symptoms. The Houston Astros play second baseman Jose Altuve, third baseman Alex Bregman, designated hitter Yordan Alvarez, catcher Martin Maldonado, and infielder Robel Garcia on the injured list as a result of health and safety protocols. The presumption is related to coronavirus. Major League Baseball is going to have the Atlantic League experiment with moving back the mound, which seems crazy to me. From 60 feet, 6 inches, the distance we've all grown up with, to 61 feet and 6 inches. Let's get to the good stuff. The Red Sox are rolling. This is what it sounded like at the end of the doubleheader in Minnesota on Wednesday.
Here's the 3-1 home. Breaking ball. That one swatted. Line drive. And a diving play out there in left field by Verdugo to end the ball game. You got to be kidding me.
You got to be kidding me. Obi with a call on Nesson right there. The Red Sox now have won 9 straight games. If Verdugo doesn't catch that ball, the Twins tie the score, and then who knows what happens. But, man, they're playing great. And what a night for Carlos Rodon, who carried a perfect game into the 9th inning for the Chicago White Sox.
Another 0-2. That's low. Almost hit him. Did Perez get hit? He did. He got clipped on the foot, and he heads to first.
Len Casper with that call on the White Sox radio network, but he still had the no-hitter. This was the 114th and last pitch for Rodon.
Another 3-2. Ground ball to third. Moncada up with it. Throw to first. It's a no-hitter. Carlos Rodon has no-hit the Cleveland Indians. The 20th no-hitter in Sox history.
What a great call at the end of the game from Len Casper. As the game was going along, his velocity grew, culminating with that last pitch, 98.8 miles per hour, his fastest in 5 years. The White Sox became the second team in Major League Baseball with 20 no-hitters, the most no-hitters for any franchise in baseball, the Dodgers with 23. Here was Carlos Rodon with SVP after last night's game.
Yeah, man, it's just one of those things. It wasn't meant to be. That was the pitch I wanted, slider back foot. I literally hit him on the top of the back foot. You just turned the page, and luckily we got the no-hitter done, and the rest is history, I guess.
I've had the good fortune doing this for a while to talk to people after nights like this, and I suppose it's always the standard question, but it's what I'm always interested in. At what point, Carlos, do you know, I got some stuff, man. Like, when does it dawn on you?
It was a good night, cold night. Cold night hitters don't like to hit, I guess.
Yeah, right?
I think it was about 40 degrees or something. Yeah, that was in my favor. But I think about the 7th inning, I had Ramirez. I had him 3-0 count. I got the strike on the 3-0 count. 3-1 fastball situation where he knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. Everybody knew it was coming. And he put a great swing on it. Ball hit to left, and we make that play. And then the Abreu play, I mean, that play freaked me out more than I was happy because Abreu went sliding in. Our MVP slided in with that knee freaking me out, but hats off to him. That was a hell of a play as well.
Now, before we talk to Sarah Langs about that no-hitter last night and we talk more about Jackie Robinson Day, baseball is back, and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with more than 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/baseball. And the NFL draft is around the corner. Check out ESPN's First Draft podcast hosted by Field Yates, Mel Kiper Jr., and Todd McShay for all the latest news and wild speculation on who your team will draft. Follow First Draft wherever you get your podcast.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
0-0-9-6.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, a reporter and producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, before we got started, you were talking about, yeah, I got some sleep. What time did you go to sleep and what was that about?
I think I went to sleep around 4 a.m. But, you know, I will do this anytime for a no-hitter, happily. You know, there's just a lot of stuff to do. Writing a story about some fun facts with some of my colleagues just based off of the no-hitter. And then there's other end-of-night stuff I've always got to do. And all of a sudden, you know, it's 4 in the morning. But I was thinking to myself, you know, am I going to get an email from Buster before I fall asleep here? Because usually when we do this podcast, when you send me an email, hey, let's get into this or whatever else, as you know, I am 100% of the time asleep when you send those. I see them within an hour or half an hour, but I'm usually asleep when it dings on my phone. So I was wondering if there might be some overlap.
We just missed. I was up at 4:30 today. As you know, I'm being an early riser. Yeah, I remember the first time I got to work with you at an event. It was the 2016 World Series, and you averaged about 42 minutes of sleep during that World Series, if I remember.
That sounds right, although I don't remember any of those 42, any of those nights. But yeah, I was there. I think I was working SportsCenter technically, but I still wanted to stick around and help with the postgame baseball tonight. So, of course, that's the entire day. And, you know, who's going to say no to being in a ballpark during a World Series or during the postgame or any of that?
Exactly. All right. What's your favorite factoids from Carlos Rodon's greatest moment of his career?
Oh my goodness. I mean, what a night. It's very difficult for me to pick one, but something that I really love, and it isn't about Carlos Rodon, and we'll get into him as well, but it's about his catcher. Zach Collins was catching the 16th game of his career. I mean, to just casually be in the beginning of your career here, he's not technically a rookie, but he's only caught 15 career games before Rodon's no-hitter last night. And that's tied for the fifth fewest career games caught before catching a no-hitter in the modern era. And what's incredible to me about this is that on the exact same day where earlier in the day we were celebrating Yadier Molina for 2,000 career games caught, he has never caught a no-hitter. We have Zach Collins' 16th game. Oh yeah, let me catch a no-hitter. I mean, that's why I love baseball so much. I know that's not about Rodon, and we'll get into his story as well, but that was probably the thing where I went to sleep thinking, I can't believe he's done this and Yadier Molina has not.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The post-game interviews, obviously Carlos was affected by his experience, but the person who seemed most emotional was Zach Collins, who made reference to the fact that people didn't believe in me as a catcher. They looked at me as a guy with no position, a first base DH guy, whereas I thought Carlos was just relieved. It felt like he was just relieved, like, whew, you know, there's always been these great expectations for me because I was a third pick in the 2014 draft. I've had some injuries. I've had some ups and downs. And now I put it all together in one night.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about those expectations all night. You know, I interned for NBC Sports Chicago in 2015, which is when he made his debut. And I can remember sitting there when he got called up and writing the first news story and, you know, going to the ballpark and just hearing about him and the expectations. And every comparison was about Chris Sale, just in terms of how they handled a young pitcher. He was initially out of the bullpen as Chris Sale was, and then they transitioned him to a starter. That was all part of the plan. And that was at the point Chris Sale was obviously still on the White Sox, and that was their, you know, big hope pitching wise. And just thinking about everything that he's been through since, with the two surgeries and being non-tendered last year and everything else, and then getting to this point. And I mean, there was a great note out there last night that it was the, he had Tommy John surgery 2 years ago, and nobody has ever come out and thrown a no-hitter that recently after Tommy John surgery. And, you know, I think that in a lot of ways that sums up his journey. I mean, only part of it, but I think that that sums up a lot of his journey really well.
And I just, my experiences, I mean, some guys like a Don Larson throws a no hitter and it wasn't like his career trajectory changed that much. I do think that having a moment like this, it almost serves as a foundation for a player in his self-perception of what he could be. I've seen that before.
Exactly. And I mean, even with what he said post-game, I mean, I think relieved is a perfect way to put it, as you were saying. And he's like, I finally did it. Like, I had this moment. His quote was something along the lines of that. I know he said, I finally did it. And it was really that kind of sentiment. And it's funny because, you know, guys will always talk about they weren't aware of the no-hitter until this point or whatever else. And he said he didn't really realize how locked in he was until the seventh inning when he had a tough at bat against Jose Ramirez. But you really did get that sense of like, look, I did this. I'm good. I maybe it's taken me some time to get here, but I am here now. And I mean, I love that. As much as we love to see the aces and everyone throw the no-hitters, I mean, these are the stories that you'll remember, even if you don't remember the specific stats from the game.
Red Sox 9-3. Yesterday, they sweep a doubleheader. And I was texting back and forth with Alex Cora on Sunday, and I mentioned to him just watching their games that looks like a team that would be a lot of fun to play on, because Kike Hernandez plays with a ton of energy. Xander Bogaerts is a great person. You know, he's a great centerpiece player. You know, Alex Verdugo, all that incredible energy. And we saw that yesterday with that great doubleheader. And it doesn't surprise me. And this is not a knock on Ron Renicky. I think Alex is very special in what he draws out of players and what they've drawn out of the Red Sox so far this year.
I completely agree. I mean, I was going to say the same thing. Absolutely no offense whatsoever to Ron Renicky, but to me, this really feels like a team that is just motivated by Alex Cora, the energy that he brings and the way that he, you know, manages players and interacts with the guys who play for him. I mean, you know, can we really attribute this type of sea change just to a manager? But I think that that's pretty much the main thing we're seeing. I mean, their bullpen has been really good. There's certainly stats to go along with it, but it really feels like a completely different team, not just personnel wise. Okay, you brought in Kike Hernandez and whomever else, but just in the way that they look at the plate. And, you know, I mean, Rafael Devers did not look like he was having any fun last year. And he just homered in four straight games before yesterday. And it's been great to see. It's funny because, you know, I think we all know a lot of Red Sox fans with the area that we live in and the area that we work in. And it's funny because it really doesn't feel like anybody saw this coming. You know, I think of the Red Sox fans who were so down on their team entering the year, and they're the first team in MLB history to lose three straight games to start a year and then immediately win 9 in a row. And yes, that sounds kind of silly and that's a little qualifiery, but that's crazy. I mean, you don't expect a team to get swept in that first series and then come back out like this. And I think that, you know, those Orioles games, they didn't just lose, they lost badly. I mean, they gave up a lot of runs, and I really don't think anyone saw this coming. And, you know, I think the best thing in sports, certainly in baseball, but across the board, is when teams really do surprise you. I just think that there's nothing really, you know, more exciting than that.
All right, let's go rapid fire. I got a handful of topics before you go. The Braves have lost four straight games, and I'm a little bit bummed about that. Not only because my son Jake is a Braves fan and he's kind of bummed about it, but because I feel like Ronald Acuna Jr. is just going crazy right now and all of it's being obscured. What about the growth of Acuna Jr. this year?
Oh my goodness. I mean, he's been so great. And you talk about growth. I mean, he's really cut down on his chase rate this year, which has been really interesting to see. It's early, but those are the types of things that you don't tend to do well in for 2 weeks and then stink out the rest of the year. So I would expect that that will continue. And I mean, he has 13 extra base hits, which is tied for the most by a Braves player through 12 games in a season with 1959 Henry Aaron. And Acuna has 2 0-for-4s. He was 0-for-4 in the second game of the season and the third game of the season. And he's still caught up to this Henry Aaron franchise record. And I mean, you know, he'll be chasing the next one, 30 games and whatever else, but it just feels like it's our nightly Acuna highlight. You know, I mean, I feel like that's what I say to myself in my head every time he comes to the plate at this point, because these last 9 games now, he's just been absolutely on fire. But you would like to see the team play better. I mean, it's unfortunate. I think that this is probably even better than anyone expected of Acuna when he was such a popular MVP pick entering the year. But you also expected the rest of the team to be playing at a pretty high level. So, I mean, I still expect that they will, but seeing them at 4-8 is just very weird, especially with what he's done.
Okay, 30 seconds. Give me your favorite stat in Corbin Burns.
Oh my gosh. I mean, first pitcher in the modern era, 30 strikeouts and no walks in the first 3 appearances of a season. Corbin Burns. I mean, to everyone who was picking the Cardinals in the Central because of questions about the Brewers pitching, there's your answer about the Brewers pitching to me.
Yankees rotation.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you know, this is what happens when you enter a season with a rotation with, you know, high risk, high reward. I think we're seeing the high risk really on display. You know, they haven't thrown a ton of innings. Only 2 teams that have played as many games of them as them have starters who've thrown fewer innings, and their ERA is 19th in the majors. So that's not where you want to be.
We got the announcement yesterday, Sarah, that the Atlantic League is going to experiment with this increased distance from the pitching mound to home plate. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, what a complete waste of time. Because the union now, with all these relievers being used, is probably 55-60% pitchers. And there's no chance pitchers would agree to this. And the players have to agree for this to be implemented. I kind of wish that they wouldn't waste their time on it and they would focus on other things. What was your thought when you saw this?
My first thought was just that 1893 is this year that Elias gives us on a lot of notes. So sometimes when you want to go all time on a pitching stat, Elias will come back and say, hey, since 1893, when the mound was moved to its current distance. And I always have to explain to people because it feels like such a random year, 1893. And I was just trying to think if one day we would be saying 2024 or whatever else it might be since the mound was moved to the new current distance. That's my very researcher answer. But I mean, I do think I agree. It seems like of all of the things that are being tested or that we've heard about, it doesn't seem the likeliest to happen to me at all. But I also, you know, noticing that this one's being tested in the Atlantic League and other things are being tested in the minors sort of was my litmus test of, you know, what the realisticness is of it, at least right now. You know, this isn't even being tested in the pipeline to majors at this point. It's being tested in independent leagues. So that was my thought. But I can't imagine anything other than 60 feet, 6 inches.
No, I just don't think pitchers would ever agree to it. And who would blame them? They'd have to completely change everything they've been doing since they were little kids in terms of, you know, how they throw and the way the ball comes out of their hands. I think it's a total waste of time until they actually have the political capital to act on something like that. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Ryan Hegeland is an Oscar winner and has been part of the movie industry for decades. And he wrote the screenplay for and served as the director of the 2013 movie about Jackie Robinson. You know that as 42. Brian, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You know, I can get ready to talk to you. I was just fascinated by your background. You're a New Englander like I'm a New Englander, but you're not, from what I understand, you weren't really like a big baseball guy. Like, I grew up a big baseball nerd. But you, on the other hand, not a baseball nerd.
No, I was more a hockey fan. We kind of lived and died with Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito and Jerry Cheevers, Derek Sanderson, those early 70s Bruins teams. But certainly I knew who the Red Sox were, you know, and I remember where I was when Carlton Fisk hit his home run, stuff like that. But yeah, I was a Bruins fanatic.
So how did you become involved in this project?
Well, it's an interesting story. My dad's from Brooklyn. He was born in Brooklyn. And he called me out of the blue one day and he said, what are you doing? And I wasn't doing anything. And he said, I want to go to Brooklyn. He was in his 80s and visit my old neighborhood. He hadn't been there in 50 years and 60 years, maybe. And I agreed. I immediately called my sister and said, is he okay? You know? And she says, yeah, he's fine. He's just sentimental. And I went home. He lives in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And rather than who would fly to New York if you could take the bus? So next thing I know, we're on the bus, 6-hour bus trip. And as we're coming into Manhattan on the bus, going to the bus station, my phone rings. And it was Thomas Tull, who's a film producer, part owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Had a film company called Legendary. And he said to me, what do you know about Jackie Robinson? And as he asked me this, the bus came to a stop on the west side of Central Park. And I looked out the window and there was a little ad on the back of one of those little tiny billboards you see in New York. And it had a picture of Robinson and it said, character, pass it on. And I'm looking at this and he's talking to me and I said, you know, I know what everyone knows about Jackie Robinson. You know, I don't not certainly have no expertise on it. And he said to me that Mrs. Robinson was she had been trying to get a film made for years and the rights had reverted back to her, the life rights to Robinson's story. And he was talking to her about doing a film. And she said, well, I certainly want to do a film, but how do you want to do it? And he's a producer. He's just doing his job of getting these rights. And he said, I need to have someone tell you how we're going to do it. And he had called me because he knew me. And I, that night, went to the bookstore near where the hotel we were staying at, bought Jackie Robinson's autobiography and a biography of him, stayed up half the night reading them, just to try to help him out, you know, and was in Brooklyn. Literally, we'd just seen there's some building there that says former site of Branch Rickey's office, which had been torn down and rebuilt to something else. And my dad loved the Dodgers, loved Pee Wee Reese and these guys. Moved to Massachusetts right before Robinson got there, but loved Jackie Robinson. And, you know, the phone rings again and it's Tall saying, we have to go see Mrs. Robinson tomorrow. So it's like, you know, first of all, you're kind of like Mrs. Robinson exists still. She exists, you know, and I'm thinking we're going to go to some house somewhere and meet her and know her down at the Jackie Robinson Foundation down in Lower Manhattan in her office. And she walks in 88 years old, She's now close to 100 years old. I think she's 98. And one of the most formidable people I've ever met in my life. And she says, how would you do this? And I said to her, in my opinion, biopics make a mistake of trying to tell the story too broadly. Start when he's a little boy, tell the story of his teenage years later. And I said, everyone, why does everyone know 42? It's because of what happened in 1947. And if I was going to tell you how to advise you how to do this story, I would stick to that because you can make a complete movie about that rather than try to tell too much and lose the drama of the story. Whether I'm right or wrong, she sparked to that. And the next thing I know in the meeting, she's talking to me about, well, how are you going to do this? And I'm thinking to myself, I'm just here trying to tell you give you my advice and trying to help out my friend who's trying to buy the rights from you, you know? And before I know it, I'm basically involved in this movie as trying to serve Mrs. Robinson and the legacy of her husband.
So I'm curious about that. As you were talking to Mrs. Robinson, were you in the back of your brain? Was there any part of you thinking that you were kind of auditioning for her, or was it purely to give your perspective as someone who's involved in movie making on how to tell the story?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little of both because I'm auditioning on behalf of the producer, but it was mostly sincerely just saying, this is how I would advise you to go about making this movie, and therefore how Thomas would go about it, so that you can know what you're getting into if you sell the rights to him, which is a big deal, because now she's entrusted him and subsequently me with how to tell this story. So it was just, this is how we do it, so you know what you're getting and how I would advise you to go about it, whether I have anything to do with it or not.
So I'm curious, I got to meet Mrs. Robinson, Rachel Robinson, once, and I totally agree with you that she has this presence, but I'm curious what you saw in her when you first met her, that you just described it in that way.
Well, also her physically, an 88-year-old woman who doesn't seem affected by age in her posture and in her way she carries herself, the way she walks into the room, the way she sits down, this is not an old person.
She struck me as being royalty. Like, yeah. I met her and I was like, this person is royalty.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like a queen. You've met a queen.
So when, and you mentioned that did she seem to immediately seize on to your thoughts about trying to confine the arc of your story?
No, she actually took a few days to think about it because she had a sense of having seen biopics before, a sense of the scope of them. And I think she needed to sit and think it through and decide if that's how she wanted to do it or not, which after a couple of days, she called Thomas and said, yeah, this is how I want to move forward. And when can you have a script? What are you doing? And we had a second meeting with her where she had agreed to all this. And she said, I'm 88 years old and I want to see this movie before I turn 90, which basically we'd have to start right then in film terms, you know, in writing and production and getting the movie edited. And in my head, I'm thinking, boo, I don't know about that. And Thomas immediately said, I guarantee you'll see this movie before.
Wow. You turn.
And I kind of side looked him and just was like, okay. And it was, we just promised this to her. And he said it sincerely. He was sincere. And we screened it for 3 months before her 90th birthday.
Wow. That's awesome. So tell me about your process of research. Cause as we established, you're not a baseball guy, like all those stories about, Clyde Sukforth and that's all stuff it becomes part of your soul if you're a baseball fan. What was your process about learning about all that and thinking how you're going to put that together in a screenplay?
And, you know, some of it, some of it, I'm aware of some of it. I'm not, you know, it's like, right. I know who Ted Williams is and things like that. And Joe DiMaggio's hit streak and the big, you know, Lou Gehrig. But I didn't know all the details of that. So I read a book. I read another book. I have a theory about that when you think you finally learned enough, then read one more book because you're going to learn something else. But the Rampersad book, the book that Jackie wrote, a book that Red Barber wrote. And the great thing about that moment in time is everyone wrote a book about it. You know, not literally everyone, but all kinds of people who were there at the time wrote a book about it. Or you could find interviews, Clyde Sukforth, you could find interviews with him over the years that he had done. Ralph Branca was who I ended up meeting and spending quite a bit of time with, was really helpful. Almost, you know, I was looking for a kind of chink in the armor for the drama, and I couldn't get it from Mrs. Robinson. And I thought to myself, because she said he never flinched, he never had a second guess, he never, you know, and I thought he's human, he had to have. And I thought, well, you're protecting your husband's legacy, and I understand that. But when I met Branca, I asked him the same question. And I met him at he has an insurance agency in Rye, New York, and I'm down there with him. And he's, you know, he's like, I don't know, I'm an insurance agent. I don't know what you want to talk to me about baseball. And I brought up the same thing about, did he ever have this sort of moment? And he got really angry with me. And he said, this is the bravest man I ever saw in my life. He said, his bravery is so astounding. He said that I wouldn't even list a number two. I wouldn't say who the second bravest man I've ever met is, because he's so far behind Robinson. It would be a disservice to Robinson to have more than one name on the list. I've met one brave man in my entire life, and it was Jackie Robinson. And that he never... whatever he was going through, he kept it to himself, basically. He didn't show it. He didn't break. He didn't, you know, no one saw anything except this. I am doing this, and you're not going to break me. You're not going to touch me. And which made it a challenge in some ways to write. It made it a challenge for Chadwick, who played him, to get into that character, you know. But a real superhero in a way. Certainly it had a huge toll on him, but he wouldn't show it to anybody.
And I was going to ask you about that. What do you remember about Chadwick becoming involved in the project? Because I, you know, and I'm not a movie person, but it always struck me. And as I saw him subsequently in other movies, you're like, yeah, he was perfect.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing about Robinson that struck me was that he knew who he was. And he's in a moment in history where the country doesn't know what it is. World War II has ended, and there's all this optimism, but, you know, black players can't play in the major leagues. And what are we? Who are we? And he knew exactly who he was. And he's a catalyst, really. He doesn't change. He changes everything around him. But he had this self-knowledge, I always felt. And so when Chad came in to read for the part, he embodied that in a way that Chad as a person knew who Chad was and was confident and had this kind of, it's that nobility that Jackie had, which I think nobility is kind of self-awareness and self-respect in a lot of ways. It starts there. And Chad had all that, and he felt that he could bring that to the screen. And also he was unknown relatively. And I thought that's in a movie where you don't want to put an icon on top of an icon, so to speak. So the fact that he was unknown to me allowed the audience to just say, that's Jackie Robinson, because I don't know him from anything else, you know, and his parents know it's not Jackie Robinson, but the audience doesn't know. So that you get past that layer of, you know, if Brad Pitt plays JFK, it takes you a while to start to see JFK.
I was curious, as you're going through, as you arrange the screenplay, as you're shooting the movie, a really important scene, and I was just as a baseball fan, I was really glad you focused on it, was the scene where Leah DeRocher gathers the players in the middle of the night when he hears about a petition being passed around among the players. You just tell me about, you know, putting that in there, because that was, as you know, Leo, I mean, you get suspended that year. He's not part of the team, but boy, he played an important role that spring.
Yeah, I mean, he straightened those guys out. The guys that were steadfast against Robinson, though they stayed steadfast against him, more or less with a couple of, Bobby Bregan was a guy who had a change of heart. But the guys that were on the fence, and I think there were plenty of them, I think he got a lot of them off the fence. I think he helped pave the way that spring training. And bear in mind, Robinson wasn't with the team. Robinson was with Montreal for a lot of that spring training, playing down in Florida, playing against them and all that. And then, you know, it was unclear, was he going to be sent back down to Montreal or was he coming up? So he laid the table in a lot of ways for Robinson's arrival on the team.
Brian, shortly after Jackie's debut, the Dodgers played the Phillies, who were managed by Ben Chapman. And Chapman aimed a tidal wave of racist words at Robinson, volley after volley of the worst kind of hate. This was obviously an important moment for you to put into the movie. What was your thoughts going into that?
Well, it's, you know, obviously it's the language and the public humiliation that goes along with it. And it felt to me like it could certainly be not enough. It could certainly be sanitized, but it never could be too much. And in a way, it had to be too much for you to really feel it. And if it was safe, we just dipped our toes in the water, so to speak, then it wouldn't have any power. And so it was relentless. It was every at bat, and it was relentless. And that you see, I think also it was Alan Tudyk is the actor who played Chapman. And I think his performance in there was very important because he played Chapman as if Chapman was enjoying himself. You know, there's two ways to play it. You could play it as just a virulent, hateful person, you know, which is part of it, certainly. But to play it as you think you're doing all this, plus you think it's fun, it made it feel even much worse. That's how little he thought of what he was doing, that it was fun. And so you just couldn't shy away from it. And it was, you know, we had extras in the stands, we had fans, and you could feel it in the cast and the crew, and everybody was just kind of like, oh my God, you know? So we knew we were on the right track there with how we were doing it.
I was going to ask you, how difficult was that scene to shoot? And you capture I've read, obviously, you know, the perceptions of players, how mortified they were, who were hearing this, and you capture that in the movie. How difficult was that to shoot that day?
I think as a kind of professionally, you think it's just, here's day 32. And it was only when we started blocking it out and rehearsed it once, kind of at half speed, that you really felt like, oh, this is real. You know, this is reality. How it must have, just a taste of what it must have felt like for him. And I remember, you know, after takes, I'd come over to Chad and I'd say, you all right? And he'd be like, yeah, yeah, you know, it was just, we didn't talk about it much, but just, are you okay? Do another take. Yeah, yeah, I'm okay. And also to Alan, who's playing Chapman, like, you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. And then we filmed the scene in the tunnel directly after doing that. So the Chad had all that in him, I think, for that scene when he's in the tunnel and he breaks his bat in the runway tunnel. But yeah, it's a uncomfortable day of work. But if you didn't feel uncomfortable, you shouldn't be doing it, kind of.
And that was an interesting choice. You know, what I've read is, as you ask questions of Mrs. Robinson, of Ralph Branca, about whether or not Jackie showed any of that anger, and you made that choice to have him react in the runway behind the dugout in the way that he did. You just talk about that?
When you see Jackie in the around the time he died, he was only in his mid-50s, and he looked like an old man. You know, he looked like an old man, and he had all the health problems of an old man. And it, you know, I'm obviously not a doctor, but it had to have killed him in a way. It had to have taken 20 years off his life. And so I knew we had to show the effect of it, but we didn't have the luxury of, or not the luxury, but we didn't have the permission really to do it in front of anybody, to do it in front of the team. I didn't have the permission from Mrs. Robinson to really do it in front of her as a character, because she said they were stoic, and they had to keep a stiff upper lip, and they couldn't relax that to each other even, or it'd be over. And so the conceit was that it happens when he's alone, he's in the tunnel by himself, and he can let loose in there. And the further conceit was that Ricky, who's his wingman, so to speak, and the guy who's put him in this situation where he gets him to the wilderness, and then he's like, I can't come in there with you. You got to go into the wilderness. I can walk you up to the door, but you got to go in there. And so the conceit was that these two men have a moment of dealing with what the human toll on Robinson. But it's really the one scene in the film where I can't point to a date and say that happened on that date. Everything else in the script, even all the at-bats, we had a researcher at the Hall of Fame, and we researched all the at-bats in the movie because I didn't want anyone to say I invented an at-bat. And I remember at one point I sent an email to the Hall of Fame, to the research department, and I said, can you tell me all the pitchers all the pitchers who hit Robinson that year, and send me a list of all the pitchers who we hit home runs off of that year. And in my head, I was like, please let him have hit a home run off a guy that's hit him. And I looked through the list, and I looked through the other list, and it's like, no. And then it's like Ostermueller. And Ostermueller hit him in the head. And apologists say, no, Ostermueller hit him in the hand. He didn't hit him in the head. And the truth of it is, yeah, he hit him in the hand, which was against the side of his head, trying to protect his head. So that's why he hit him in the hand. Anyways, it was just like, it was to the film gods and the baseball gods, thank you very much. Because I didn't want to invent that scene. I wanted him to hit a home run off a guy who had hit him earlier in the season. And if I had to invent it, I wouldn't invent it, because then someone would say, you're lying, and therefore you're lying about other things.
And as you know, of course, what's in the movie, you know, Harrison Ford saying to Chad, Branch Rickey saying to Jackie Robinson, we want you to have the strength to not fight back. And then after that, and I've often, you know, having read about him, thought about, my goodness, how difficult that must have been for Jackie. He was so competitive. I mean, that is so clear. And then in subsequent years, after he has done what Branch Rickey is asking, and Branch Rickey effectively says, you know, go ahead and react that way. Wow, the stuff that went on between he and Leo DeRocher, and, you know, that play, I'm sure you've seen the video of it, where he basically ends the career of Davey Williams, a Giants infielder, by giving him a hip going in. I'm with you, where I've thought about the absolute rage that must have been within him all of 1947.
Yeah, and really what the trick Ricky pulls off is he finds the guy who's the greatest fighter and then says to him, you can't fight, because you're going to need all that fight to not be able to fight, you know, in a sense. You know, I have to ask, you know, Joe Louis not to throw a punch. You know, it's like, it's kind of a brilliant insight into human nature of who better not to fight than a guy who can fight.
So the movie comes out, and I'm curious about your conversation with Ralph Branca first. After the movie comes out, what did he say to you?
Well, he said, first of all, the guy who played him wasn't handsome enough to play him.
And that, everything I know, I met him once. I met Ralph once, and that totally sounds like him.
Yeah, yeah. But I go, well, just two things about him. He liked the movie a lot. He really, you know, he thought it captured it and all those things. Another thing is that there's all these who signed the petition. And we have the scene where the guys are signing the petition. And I was very, I didn't want any name to be on there that hadn't been, that hadn't signed that petition. And there's sort of a in baseball history, there's a group of names that are acknowledged as the signees. And I showed that list to Branca and I said, do I have this right? Because he saw the petition. And he said, yeah, those guys all signed. And he goes, a couple of other guys signed too. And I said, well, I don't just want these guys if you're sure of it. And he's like, yeah, I'm sure of it. So that was very helpful. But the other thing was, is that, because obviously he gave up the Bobby Thompson home run, which is all he's ever been asked about for, you know, for decades. And when we were all done talking about Robinson, and he was always a curmudgeon, you know, he didn't give in on that. And when he was all done, he looked at me and he said, is there anything else you want to ask me? And I knew he was talking about Bobby Thompson. And I said, no, Mr. Branca, that's all I want to ask you. And then he smiled and he was like, well, thanks. It was nice meeting you. Thank you very much. But it was like, you're okay. You're not going to ask me about that.
Yeah, I love the portrayal of him in the movie because he was such a, especially for his time, such a wonderful, progressive mind.
Yeah.
And yeah. He also, you know, as I love the portrayal of him, essentially being a witness to history, it felt like.
Yeah.
Taking all this in and sort of absorbing it and being appalled by what he's seeing.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, putting in the support where you could put in the support and all that. All you can do, you can never be that guy. All you can do is offer up some solace where you can, you know, even if the guy doesn't want it.
One day he had a special visitor to come to set. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. But we had Hank Aaron visit the set, and we were in the middle of shooting, but we had a bunch of footage cut together, probably about a half hour. And when we broke for lunch, we showed about a half hour of footage. Tull had brought him down to the set, Thomas, and we showed him about a half hour of footage, rough cut stuff. And when it was all done, he goes, yep. He goes, that's the way it was. And I was so pleased. It was sort of, it was very matter of fact, but it was, we got a sign off from him. So, and obviously, and Robinson was his hero as a young guy. So that was a great moment, getting to meet him.
I love the honesty of it. You know, I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
You guys, you did an amazing job with it. All right. So what did Mrs. Robinson say to you after she saw it?
Yeah, we screened it for at a theater near Lincoln Center. She lives in New York. And she, with a crowd, we wanted her to see it with an audience. So we had a kind of semi-recruited audience there. So she saw it with about 100 people and a lot of people from the foundation and a lot of friends of hers and things like that. And it was a work print. And not to get into technical aspects of it, but it wasn't a smooth sound mix. So I sat in the back with basically a master volume control because I had to turn it up and down in some spots because we didn't have a smooth mix yet. So this, we don't blow anyone's ears out. And when it ended, I couldn't get to her right away because I'm about 20 rows away and she's surrounded by people who are talking to her about it. And I finally, after about 10 minutes or so, maybe got to her and she was wet-eyed. Teary-eyed, I should say, which is quite a thing for her. Again, because she's as stoic and brave as he is any day of the week. And I said, what did you think, Mrs. Robinson? And she looked at me and she said, I loved how many times we kissed. and I just thought of all the things she could have said, it was the most kind of, I never would have expected something like that, but it was the greatest thing she could say to me, you know.
And that's an emotional memory for you. I'm seeing it. I'm hearing it.
And in effect, it was like I got to spend the evening with my husband, you know, and that was him. That was him. It's a very human thing, but it's the greatest achievement of my career, really.
That's awesome. Ryan, thank you for doing this.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Thursday. First up, we have Elizabeth Hart at eHart Tweets. She writes in, as discussed during Mets Phillies, you agree that if there's zero out, runners at first and third, and the batter hits into a double play, but the run scores, they should get an RBI. Why or why not?
No, I like the fact, Elizabeth, that they don't get credit for an RBI. Look, it's one thing, let's say, you know, runner at third base and you hit a fly ball or you hit a ground ball to the right side and a run scores. You know, that seems like, you know, potentially an intentional act where you're trying to generate the run. On the other hand, if you have a situation where you hit into a double play and two outs are created and the other team, for the most part, gets relief by getting the double play, I don't think a hitter should be rewarded for that. I don't like them getting an RBI. What about you, Taylor?
Yeah, I don't think so either. I'm with you there, Buster. Elizabeth, very invested into RBIs. She's tweeted about us about RBIs before. Next okay. up, and last one for today, we have Frank at Cinegrades 2. He writes, in seeing Abreu absolutely risk a serious injury to keep a perfect game at the time in play last night got me thinking, who in the game right now is widely considered to be a great teammate across the league?
Yeah, and for years, CeCe Sabathia, of course, had a reputation of being an elite teammate, someone who was inclusive and drew everybody closer together. I think, Frank, that Abreu is absolutely one of those guys. You know, we had the White Sox and Angels on our first Sunday night broadcast, and I asked Tony La Russa about that, and he compared him to managing Albert Pujols in terms of his leadership.
Wow.
You know, Tony referred to the time and for Tony La Russa to inject Albert Pujols, mm-hmm. yeah. that is a huge compliment for him to talk about how good of a leader Abreu is.
Absolutely. That does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Thanks for writing in, everyone.
That's it for today. My thanks to Brian, Sarah, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Enjoy Jackie Robinson Day. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.